Club History, the show that brings you fascinating stories from Boston history. This is episode 26, Isaiah Thomas and the American Oracle of Liberty. Hi, I'm Nikki.
And I'm Jake. This week, we're going to talk about Isaiah Thomas, colonial printer and founder of the Massachusetts Spy, whose office became known by the British as the Sedition Foundry. He shared firsthand accounts of the battles of Concord and Lexington, eventually spread his business empire across multiple states, and founded the American Antiquarian Society in Worcester, Massachusetts. But before we talk about Isaiah, it's time to take a look at what's coming up this week in Boston history.
Monday is April 24th, and on April 24th, 1704, bookseller John Campbell published the first edition of the Boston Newsletter. It was the first newspaper to enter regular circulation in America and remained the only newspaper in Boston for the next 15 years. It was not, however, the first attempt by Bostonians to publish a local paper. All the way back in 1690, a paper called Public Occurrences, Both Foreign and Domestic, was printed in Boston. However, the publisher had not gotten legal approval for the newspaper, and there was no First Amendment yet. After that first issue, the royal governor shut the operation down. Campbell's Boston Newsletter was more successful. Early editions consisted mostly of reprints and adaptations of news articles from Old England with a brief local news section. The first edition was very concerned with Catholic France stirring up rebellions in Scotland and Ireland, as well as Queen Anne's speech to Parliament and response. The newsletter even continued publishing through the Siege of Boston, at that time in the hands of a third generation of printers. This week's podcast will discuss how the printer of the Massachusetts Spy, a competing paper, was forced to flee from the city at the beginning of the siege, while the Boston Newsletter was printed in Boston through February of 1776, just before the British evacuation. We'll have a link to the first issue of the Boston Newsletter in the show notes this week at hubhistory.com/026, so you can see what was newsworthy on April 24th, 1704.
John Adams' diary entry from April 25th, 1771, gives us some insight into what humor was like in the 18th century. Attorney Adams was making the rounds with the circuit court and found himself having dinner in Worcester with friends and fellow lawyers. One of them told a joke that went, "The Duke of York was in a battle at sea. A cannonball hit a man's head and dashed his blood and brains out in the Duke's face and eyes. The Duke started and leaped quite out of the rank. The officer who commanded said, 'Pray, Your Highness, don't be frightened.' The Duke replied, 'Oh, sir, I'm not frightened, but I wonder what business that fellow had here with so much brains in his head.'" And then another member of the group replied with a joke that must have been pretty off-color for the time. A father caught a young fellow naked in bed with his daughter. The old man, between grief and rage, broke out into reproaches. "You wretch! What do you mean by trying to get my daughter with child?" The young fellow answered him, "Trying to get your daughter with child? I was trying not to get her with child." We'll have that full diary entry in this week's show notes.
Wednesday is April 26th. The so-called sacred cod is a legislative tradition dating back to the early 1700s. In honor of the importance of fishing to the Massachusetts economy, a hand-carved wooden cod had hung over the Massachusetts House of Representatives for generations. The first one burned in the 1747 Old State House fire, and the second disappeared during the Siege of Boston. The third cod had been hanging over legislators' heads since 1784. When the new State House opened in 1798, the cod was wrapped in an American flag and carried up Beacon Hill from the old State House in a solemn procession. So you can imagine the confusion when the State House press room received a panicky phone call on April 26, 1933. The sacred cod was missing. The Boston police began investigating, the state police started dredging the Charles River, and the legislature declared that they couldn't govern without their cod and promptly took a break. Two nights later, the chief of the Harvard Police Department got an anonymous tip that he could find something interesting near the Chestnut Hill Reservoir. Upon arriving, he noticed a suspicious car with no license plates. After a 20-minute, OJ-esque, low-speed chase down the West Roxbury Parkway, the car pulled over. Two men got out and handed over the cod, then sped away. The heist had been the product of an ongoing feud between the editors of Harvard's official student newspaper, The Crimson, and their humorous rivals, the Harvard Lampoon. As the war of pranks escalated, a group of Lampoon editors walked into the State House, clipped the wires holding the cod, dropped the 4-foot, 11-inch statue into a flower delivery box for long-stemmed roses, and walked right out the front door. How this was supposed to exact revenge on the Crimson, quite honestly, escapes me. We'll have links to a story about the heist and a picture of a detective posing with the returned cod in this week's show notes.
On April 27, 1713, court held session in Boston's new brick townhouse for the first time. The original townhouse, which was used as both the town hall and the seat of the colonial government, was built in 1657. It was constructed of wood, with the ground floor left open to be used as market stalls, and then two floors above supported by massive wooden beams. That building burned to the ground in a great fire on October 2, 1711. The replacement structure was built of brick and adorned with large gilded statues of the royal lion and unicorn. We know it today as the Old State House, though as we heard in yesterday's anniversary, it was gutted again by fire in 1747. Presiding Judge Samuel Sewell recorded the opening in his diary without elaboration. 1713, April 27th. First court held in the new townhouse in Boston. Mr. Coleman prayed excellently. In the show notes this week, we'll have an architectural drawing of the original townhouse, as well as some pictures we took of the current Old State House. We'll also link to an episode of the excellent Ben Franklin's World podcast that explores colonial-era public markets in Boston, including the original townhouse.
Friday is April 28th. In a report dated April 28th, 1969, the city of Boston laid out its half-billion-dollar plan to host a bicentennial expo in 1976. The event would have been held at a new neighborhood and conference center to be built on new land created in Boston's harbor near City Point and the mouth of the Neponset River. The plan would not only have the exposition serve as an urban laboratory during the exposition period, but, of greater importance locally, it would also leave behind the beginning of a permanent new harbor community for the city of Boston. The city of Boston is in desperate need of new land, new recreation facilities, new housing facilities, new properties to broaden its shrinking tax base, and in particular, new housing facilities for the elderly and others on fixed incomes. The commission has been particularly impressed by the fact that most of the 690-acre site proposed to house the exposition slash new community will be on land which today is non-existent. Some 400 acres will be created by landfill in a system of pier platforms. A third system of land creation proposed would consist of floating or flexible platforms. Of particular importance is the fact that the construction of the grounds will not entail the raising of existing neighborhoods, with resultant displacement of citizens and existing taxable income-producing properties. Fortunately, this plan went the way of the Olympics. Into the recycling bin. In the show notes this week, we'll link to the project's financials, and we'll have pictures of the shockingly ambitious project, which obviously was never built.
A polemic titled Submission, Reconciliation, or Independence was published in Boston on April 29, 1776. After the British evacuated Boston, there was a great debate as to what the desired outcome of the war should be. The author of this piece clearly has an opinion. It is acknowledged on all hands, if a reconciliation were to take place, that it would be a temporary one. Whigs and Tories confess the colonies will one day fall from Great Britain. If this should happen 50 years hence and the colonies be disunited, what will be the consequence? Several distinct empires will be set up. The southern provinces may form one, the northern another, and Canada a third. Perpetual discord, obstinate rivalry, and ambitious contests for dominion, like those of Carthage and Rome, will follow, till the standard of absolute government is established by the victorious empire over the rest, and thus, if we neglect the present union, this land of freedom may become as tyrannical as Siam or Bengal. I appeal to you, O philanthropists who are breathing for peace, and to you, ye Tories, who are preaching dependence, whether the most prudent method for ourselves and the most peaceful for posterity is not to set up independence, and to continue the war till that independence is established and acknowledged. It is unnecessary to add that if we reject the first two, that is, submission and dependence, we must, of consequence, be independent. We'll have a link to that piece in this week's show notes.
Finally, Sunday is April 30th. The founder of the West End Street Railway gave an address in Somerville on April 30, 1891. He argued in favor of converting the street railways from horsepower to electric power and against state regulation of transportation. There are people who believe that we can carry people and give them a seat all the way from Somerville to Boston and for a single fare of 5 cents. Well, now, what is the remedy? Is there any remedy for it? There is but one practical remedy, and that is by the introduction of a cheaper system of motive power. There is a system of motive power which 2 years ago was in the experimental stage, and which the West End Railway Company has been introducing ever since, and I am happy to say that the expectations indulged in at that time have been more than realized. But when I look back upon it, and see what we have done or what we undertook to do 2 years ago, it looks almost like recklessness. The thing is in its early, incipient stage, but we are building powerhouses which shall provide power at the cheapest possible cost. Great improvements are being made in the machinery. Now, that is the system that the city of Somerville is interested in having adopted, and having adopted at the earliest possible moment. We'll have a link to Henry Whitney's speech to the Central Club of Somerville in this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/026. And now it's time to turn to the main event. Seditious principles are of no use to anyone if you don't have a way to broadcast them. Today, the resistance has an arsenal of social media platforms. In 1770, we had the Massachusetts Spy. Let's start with some background on printer Isaiah Thomas.
Isaiah Thomas was born in Boston in 1749. When Thomas was just a few years old, his father abandoned the family, leaving a mother and 5 children with no income. In a move that would set the trajectory for the rest of his life, the city's overseers of the poor arranged for Isaiah to be apprenticed to the printer Zechariah Fowle. At just 6 years old, and having had no prior education, Isaiah learned the alphabet and the type blocks at the same time. Unlike many young apprentices, Isaiah took to his trade, managing a print shop and gaining a reputation as a skilled printer by his teenage years. These early years were filled with the typical hijinks, mischief, and fun that a young man could have in colonial Boston. From his memoir, we have a remarkable snapshot of young Isaiah's experience of Pope's Night, which you may recall we discussed in our very first episode.
Nowhere in the British Dominions was the 5th of November, the anniversary of the discovery of the gunpowder plot, celebrated with more zeal and zest and mock pomp and ceremony than in the good town of Boston. Strife and rivalry had for some time existed between the north and south ends of the town, which should have the more august celebration and soonest put to rout the procession and parade of the other. The line of division between the north and the south was the old Mill Creek, now Blackstone Street. Collections were levied upon the inhabitants on the morning of the day, and asked for, but few thought it was quite safe to refuse. The money was spent in part for the pomp and circumstance of war, and largely for liquor. The principal effigies of the Pope and the Devil, the supposed instigators of the plot, were placed on a stage mounted on cartwheels and drawn by horses. At the front of the stage was a large lantern of oiled paper, 4 or 5 feet wide and 8 or 9 feet high. On the front was painted in large letters, "The Devil Take the Pope," and just below this, "North End Forever," or "South End Forever." Behind the lantern sat the Pope in an armchair, and behind the Pope was the Devil, standing erect with extended arms, one holding a smaller lantern, the other grasping a pitchfork. The heads of Pope and Devil were on poles, which went through their bodies and the stage beneath. Boxed up out of sight sat a boy whose mission was to sway the heads from side to side as fancy suggested. The Devil, without consideration for his home climate, was clad in tar and feathers, from top to toe and from head to foot. Other effigies were sometimes seen, suspended from gallows, of persons who had incurred the indignation and hatred of the mob, as the Pretender, Admiral Byng, Earl Bute, and Lord North. Ancillary devils and popes were drawn or carried by men and boys, as various in size as the men and boys who bore them, some even on shingles and bits of board. Assembling about dusk, North End and South End, under their respective leaders, processions were formed. The lanterns, great and small, lighted, and through a speaking trumpet the order was given to move on. With this, the noise and tumult began, the blowing of conch shells, whistling through the fingers, beating with clubs the sides of the houses, cheering, huzzaing, swearing, or rising above all the din, the cry, "North End forever," or "South End forever." The devils on the stages were not the only or chiefest proof that the underworld was let loose. The procession that first reached the Mill Creek gave three cheers and rushed on to meet their foes. As they approached, the strife began. Clubs, stones, and brickbats were freely used, and though persons were not often killed, bruised shins, broken heads and bones were not infrequent. It was on one of these peaceful nights, when the North Enders had been as far south as the Elm Tree, soon after so well known as the Liberty Tree, and were on their return, masters of the situation, though now and then receiving a complimentary brick from South Enders secreted in lane or passageway, that our little printer, with a large bump of curiosity and a small one of caution, pressed through the crowd to read the labels on the lanterns. A brick aimed at the lantern lighted on his head and struck him to the ground. The chances were for the little fellow to be trampled to death by the rushing crowd, but as his good fortune or a kind providence would have it, the first man whose foot struck him, hearing his groans, lifted him up, and persons coming around with lights, one of them recognized him, took him in his arms, and carried him to his master's house. A surgeon being sent for, it was found that no bone was broken, and in a few days he was able to return to his types. Such is in substance the account given by Mr. Thomas in later years. It does not speak very well for the refinement of manners of what was then the most cultivated town in British America, and is worth perhaps the passing notice of those who are continually asking why the former days were better than these. A lengthy passage, but worth deviating for. But now, back to Isaiah's apprenticeship.
The relationship between Thomas and Fowle was not without conflict. Fowle was not a very successful printer, with the business limited to one-page songs called broadside ballads and cheap pamphlets. He also failed to fulfill his obligation to adequately provide for Isaiah's education. Nonetheless, Thomas was extremely bright and soon became a better printer and businessman than Fowle. And then, just like Ben Franklin, Thomas ran away from his apprenticeship in hopes of making it to London. He traveled up and down the East Coast, taking temporary jobs from South Carolina all the way to Nova Scotia, but he could not raise the funds needed to cross the Atlantic. And so, as a 16-year-old in 1765, he found himself in Halifax working for the sole printer, Anthony Henry, at the Halifax Gazette. In a short time, Henry moved on and left the business in the care of Thomas. And what else happened in 1765?
The Stamp Act.
Yes, and young Isaiah Thomas, now in charge of a newspaper using lots of, you guessed it, paper, had a lot to say about this political development. As a reminder, the Stamp Act imposed a tax on anything printed. Thomas published articles against the Stamp Act, printed this tax stamp upside down, created images of the devil attacking the stamp, and went so far as to cut all the stamps off of his supply of paper. But the good people of Halifax didn't share the rebellious nature of Bostonians. They were not looking to disobey the crown, and after 7 months, Thomas was no longer welcome.
Thomas traveled around for several years, taking odd printing jobs and gaining the worldliness that made for a sharp mind before returning to Boston in 1770. He then made amends with and entered into a partnership with Fowle, establishing the Massachusetts Spy, a newspaper for the middle class. Thomas was soon so successful that he could purchase the business from Fowle, including the printing press on which he learned to print, affectionately referred to as Old Number One. Thomas initially tried to keep the paper politically impartial, but public sentiment in Boston, unlike in Halifax, was so strongly leaning towards revolution that it became impossible to remain impartial, and the Spy became a voice for the patriot cause. The Massachusetts Spy was one of the most successful newspapers in North America with a circulation of 3,500. For comparison, most colonial newspapers carried a circulation of between 500 and 1,000. Post riders and ships carried the Spy to readers throughout the 13 colonies. Of all the patriotic papers, the spy contained the most fervent rhetoric and did much to anger and unify Americans in their support against the mother country. During this time, Thomas was frequently in trouble with the authorities. He was closely connected to patriot leaders, and many believed the Sons of Liberty met at the offices of the spy. Thomas later recalled he had the honor of being included with John Hancock and Samuel Adams in a list of 12 persons who were to be summarily executed when taken. He also had the distinct honor of being burned in effigy. Remember that without the protection of the First Amendment today, each article criticizing the government was considered an act of treason that placed his shop and his personal liberty at risk. He was called before the Governor's Council twice and sought representation from James Otis. In 1771, Governor Hutchinson ordered that Thomas be prosecuted for malicious libel, but the grand jury refused to indict. In response, British soldiers paraded before the spy office, and Thomas was threatened with tarring.
Yet the resistance carried on, and rebellion fomented. He secretly published handbills for the Sons of Liberty and arranged for postwriters to exchange news and papers with like-minded citizens in other colonies. Fast forward to the spring of 1775, and things are really coming to a head. Joseph Warren has built up a powerful intelligence network, and the Patriot leaders know that something is about to happen. They become very concerned that Thomas's printing press and other property will be seized, or that he'll be taken into custody. In the middle of the night on April 16, 1775, Thomas packed up his press and was ferried across the river to Charlestown. He later wrote, referring to himself in the third person, that he had rendered himself very obnoxious to the friends of the British administration and, in consequence, the Tories and some of the British soldiery in town openly threatened him with the effects of their resentment. He was induced to pack up privately a press and types and to send them in the night over the Charles River to Charlestown, whence they were conveyed to Worcester. As we now know, a lot happened that week. Thomas would soon find himself one of dozens of men riding throughout Middlesex County on the evening of April 18th, rallying the militia to turn out to Concord the next morning. On May 3rd, he would print a first-hand account of what transpired. "Americans, forever bear in mind the Battle of Lexington, where British troops, unmolested and unprovoked, wantonly, and in a most inhuman manner, fired upon and killed a number of our countrymen, then robbed them of their provisions, ransacked, plundered, and burnt their houses. Nor could the tears of defenseless women, some of whom were in the pains of childbirth, the cries of helpless babes, nor the prayers of old age, confined to beds of sickness, appease their thirst for blood, or divert them from the design of murder and robbery." You might say there's a little bit of bias in that reporting, and perhaps some fake news, but it does give him the distinction of being America's first war correspondent.
It's believed that Thomas was also the first person in Massachusetts to read the Declaration of Independence when the rider carrying it from Philadelphia to Boston stopped in Worcester on July 14, 1776. He took the document to the steps of the meeting house and read it aloud to a crowd of citizens. Now, as you can imagine, the Revolution is not good for Thomas's business, and in the early years, he leased the daily running of the spy to first William Stearns and Daniel Bigelow, and then Anthony Haswell. They all lacked his skills at reporting, printing, and transacting business. Quality suffered and subscriptions declined. When the second lease was up, Thomas again took control of the spy with the issue of July 2, 1778. From this point on, Thomas would remain in Worcester and in control of the paper and an increasing number of other publications and books. Throughout the rest of the war years, his business would fluctuate widely, but after the war, it grew exponentially, reaching its greatest successes from 1790 to 1802. As one example of the growth of his business, consider his printing of almanacs. In 1781, he printed and sold 3,000 almanacs, while in the year 1797, he printed and sold over 29,000. In order to ensure the quality of all aspects of the printing process, Thomas set up a paper mill and bookbinding operation. He had a controlling interest in 3 newspapers, a magazine, and 8 bookstores in Massachusetts, New Hampshire, New York, and Maryland. At the height of his business, he operated 16 presses throughout the country and employed over 150 people in Worcester alone.
In addition to being a great creator of books, Thomas was also a great scholar and collector of them. He retired from active business pursuits in 1802 to write The History of Printing in America. This two-volume work, first published in 1810, is still considered an important source on early American printers and the publishing industry. Thomas collected an enormous amount of material from which he wrote his History of Printing. In 1812, he founded the American Antiquarian Society as a learned society and library devoted to American history and culture. It's now the third oldest historical society in the country, but the first to be national in scope. At the first meeting, Thomas was elected president, a role he held until his death in 1831. In addition to nearly 8,000 volumes from his collection, he gave land and a hall with a provision for its maintenance. He then traveled the country, visiting newspaper offices and purchasing as many back issues as he could. He believed that newspapers were the single best records of the thoughts and actions of the common people who made the revolution a success. You can learn more about Isaiah Thomas, the Massachusetts spy, and the American Antiquarian Society in this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/026.
We'll share a portrait of Isaiah Thomas and a link to lesson plans from teachushistory.org, which were a great resource for this episode. We'll also link to the full text of his book, The History of Printing in America, which includes the passage on Pope's Night. Additionally, we'll share a video recreation of Isaiah Thomas publishing the May 3, 1775 issue of the Massachusetts Spy, and a transcript of the issue, which reports on the battles of Lexington and Concord. If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We're at Hub History on Twitter and at facebook.com/hubhistory. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. And while you're on the site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode. If you subscribe on iTunes, we'd love it if you could write us a brief review. It's the best way to help others find the show.
That's all for now. We'll be back next time with an episode we're calling Burned at the Stake.